Everybody, Mike Malloy here. Thanks for tuning in. In just a moment, we're going to be joined by Kevin Zeese. He's co-director of It's Our Economy and organizer of the National Occupation of Washington, D.C. He is one of the original organizers of Occupy Washington, D.C. Before we talk with Kevin about healthcare, I want to mention the death Tuesday of Adrienne Rich. The Times calls her a poet of towering reputation and towering rage. She died at her home in Santa Cruz on Tuesday. She was 82. And as her obituary says, for decades she was among the most influential writers of the feminist movement and one of the best-known American public intellectuals. She wrote 24 volumes of poetry and half a dozen of prose. The poetry alone has sold nearly 800,000 copies. Triply marginalized as a woman, a lesbian, and a Jew, Ms. Rich was concerned in her poetry and in her many essays with identity politics long before the term was coined. I first became aware of her writing in the early 80s when someone gave me a copy of Diving into the Wreck. If you get a chance, find it and read it. But one poem that stuck out, and I'm going to share it with you very quickly, that she wrote is called Aunt Jennifer's Tigers. It's about a woman working at her needlework, working perhaps on a quilt. Aunt Jennifer's Tigers prance across the screen, bright topaz denizens of a world of green. They do not fear the men beneath the tree. They pace in sleek, chivalric certainty. Aunt Jennifer's fingers fluttering through her wool find even the ivory needle hard to pull. The massive weight of Uncle's wedding band sits heavily upon Aunt Jennifer's hand. When Aunt is dead, her terrified hands will lie still ringed with ordeals she was mastered by. The tigers and the panel that she made will go on prancing, proud and unafraid. So, if you get a chance, I know a lot of people listening to this program are very familiar with Adrienne Rich, but if you get a chance, read some of her poetry. I really recommend Diving into the Wreck. Won a National Book Award for poetry in 1974 and is considered her masterwork. Adrienne Rich. Again, Kevin Zeese. I met Kevin back in October last year when I participated in the October 2011.org movement in Washington, D.C. that eventually linked up with Occupy Washington, D.C. I met Kevin and his partner, Dr. Margaret Flowers, and had a chance to see dedicated activism in action. Most people in the activist community know who Kevin and Margaret Flowers are, and they are held in very high respect in that community and outside that community. Kevin joins us now from Baltimore. Hey, Kevin.
Thank you very much for having me on. Hear your voice again.
Absolutely. It was good to see you in D.C. Let me just give a little preamble here. when I was in D.C., the 2 days that I was there interviewing people on who were supportive of the Affordable Care Act, a lot of those people, I made it very clear that my position was single payer, and that I saw the Affordable Care Act as either the camel's nose under the tent or a complete diversion away from what we should be going for in this country. It was very interesting. I was invited to do this. Well, in the middle of it, I think it was the first or second, I think the first day, I looked up and there was Kevin and Margaret who had stopped in looking for a chance to talk about this very same issue, but from a different perspective. The event that I was participating in was so highly organized and tightly controlled. I had to say I can't work you in, which made me feel like a total ass. And I think perhaps other people who might have wanted to interview Kevin and or Margaret also were in the same position. So I wanted him to come on the program tonight. So we do not have 4 minutes to talk. We have as much time as we want. So
what a deal.
Yeah, well, having said all that, I read your essay. Your piece, I guess I found it at Huffington Post, Partisan Confusion Outside the Supreme Court While the Health Insurance Mandate is Debated. And I want to get, first of all, your take on those on the Democratic liberal side who are in support of ACA and those on the Republican conservative side who are not. That's a false divide to you and to Margaret.
Totally. I mean, I think the reality is that both of the leadership of the two parties want to keep the insurance industry intact, and they're just using this as a political tool. I imagined when I was standing out there that if John McCain had been elected president and passed the same act, which, by the way, first came from the Heritage Foundation, a right-wing think tank, then was put in place by Romney in Massachusetts. So it would not have been far-fetched for McCain to have done the same thing as Obama did. And if he had, I could see the Koch-funded Americans for Prosperity on the opposite side and the SEIU, National Organization of Women, other Democrat groups on the other side, just taking the opposite positions. It was just like, it's such an incredible show. We were walking through the crowd, and we saw a couple of Americans for Prosperity folks, and they were in their late 60s, so we asked, do you have Medicare? They said, yes. Do you like Medicare? We love it. Do you think everybody should have it? Yes. So why are you with Americans for Prosperity? They're trying to end Medicare. They're not trying to expand everybody. And then, of course, with the Democrat folks, it's, do you like the insurance companies? No. So why do you think we should be forced to buy insurance from companies you don't like? Because it's a step in the right direction. To what? Single payer. Single payer gets rid of the insurance companies, right? Yes. So how is forcing us to buy from the insurance companies a step in the direction of getting rid of the insurance companies? Isn't that the opposite? Well, it's a step in the right direction. That's the way we can get there. But it's the opposite direction. How is this a step in the right direction? Well, we have to reelect President Obama.
Right. No, I'm real familiar with that line of quote reasoning, end quote.
Yeah, I'm sure at the event that you were at, you heard all these same talking points. I mean, everybody there, every moment was scripted, and every spokesperson had been given talking points, and every talking point was reiterated and reiterated by every radio interview, and so the American public was deceived. They were given a talking point, a Democrat a PAP. About this being a step in the right direction, when it's actually a step in the wrong direction. It's a terrible direction. I've got to say, when I heard Justice Kennedy and Chief Justice Roberts and the questions they were asking, they were right on target.
Right.
Where does this stop?
Right. All right. Let me ask you something. And you'll have to wait till after the break, Kevin, if you don't mind to answer it. But the question is, how then are so many people who are natural allies of the liberal left or the progressive left? So many people that I had a chance to talk to, and people that I saw inside that conference room who were being interviewed by other folks. How are they? Have they become? I don't want to say willing dupes of the insurance industry. I hope that's not the case, because we're talking about union organizers. We're talking about people who are deeply concerned about what is happening in the insurance realm of the fact that people can't get insurance or there are all sorts of restrictions the insurance companies continue to gouge and to beat and to take advantage of. So my question when we come back is just how people of apparently good conscience can be so duped. We're talking with Kevin Zeese. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
To the flying monkey right, it's more Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Philip Holbrook. Thanks, Philip. We're talking with Kevin Zeese, author, activist, and one of the people responsible for an awful lot of action that goes on in this country where consciousness raising is the ultimate goal. All right, the people who are supporting the idea of the Affordable Care Act, people of good conscience. How does this happen, Kevin?
We have that's a very good question. It's a deep question because it really ties into a lot of the propaganda that we are forced to listen to in the media. We have lots of talking heads from both political parties, some pretending to be reporters now that they've finished their time as Democratic or Republican operatives. And we have very top-down organized unions, where the heads of the unions of SEIU, for example, had more visits to the White House than anyone else, the head of the SEIU did, in the first year of Obama's administration. So they're very tight with President Obama. And it's a very top-down union. So people do what they're told when they, are working in an environment where they need a paycheck. I'm sure the people who are out there on the Democrat side from the Supreme Court mostly support a single payer. 80% of Democrats do, according to polls.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sure they're out there wanting single payer, and they either have to convince themselves that this walking in the opposite direction will get them where they want to go, or they're just doing what they're told. And it's just a very manipulated society. We have this two-party corporate duopoly, and that's the only choices we're given, so people feel hopeless.
Is there any possibility, I hear what you're saying about the two corporate parties, and I don't disagree. As a matter of fact, that's one of the points that I grind on this program endlessly. And one of the reasons, one of the reasons that we're not looked on too favorably by certain major advertising agencies. But aside from all that, is it possible that the technique being employed, if not by Obama, by someone else, I don't know who it would be, that it is the two steps forward, one step back technique? I've heard over and over again from people, usually off the record, because they are either Democratic Party operatives or people who have an interest in the Democratic Party and are afraid of, I guess, of being openly quoted, but who say, look, we get some of these provisions in place where people are used to not being turned down because of pre-existing conditions. People are used to not having caps on the lifetime of their policy. People get used to, young people, of being included on their parents' insurance until age 26. And, okay, so we are throwing 35, 40, 50 million people into the clutches of the insurance companies, but we also have some restrictions on what they can do to this crowd. If we do this now, is it not then possible to convince the people who have been getting those particular kinds of guarantees and become used to them, that the real idea is to get rid of the insurance companies altogether and go to single payer. Do you see the possibility that that might be a technique or a plan? Or
I don't think it's a plan at all. I mean, I think what is it, what those kind of things, the provisions you mentioned, there are the kinds of crumbs that they give us when they want to do the big thing, which is force people to buy insurance, you know, spend 8% of their income on a corporate product, and they throw a few crumbs out. You know, with each one of those, like the pre-existing illness, for example, there's all sorts of things in the Obama law that the insurance companies can benefit from, as far as they can, you know, raise coverage for age, raise coverage for if you're overweight or have other health problems. I mean, so you can, while you get in on a pre-existing illness, you get punished with something, you know, somewhere else. And so it's a, this bill, you have to realize, was written by a former insurance company executive. And she worked for Max Baucus, of the chairman of the finance committee. And after the bill was passed, President Obama hired her to implement the law at HHS. And so this is an insurance bill. This is for the insurance company. They gave him $20 million in his first election campaign effort. They don't give that money for no reason. You know, strings are attached when that kind of money is involved.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that this that will lead that way. The only thing that we can really hope for, I think, at this stage is that the libertarian views of people on the right side of the Supreme Court really do recognize that this does change the relationship between citizen and government fundamentally, as Justice Kennedy said, and that there's no clear way to stop that from going into other areas. And we have a pension crisis right now.
Mm-hmm.
Why not a exchange with J.P. Morgan, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, Chase, Citi, and we're all forced to buy a pension? You know, when the next economic crisis happens and Detroit's under threat, why not? We're forced to buy an American car. Of course, we get a subsidy from the government to make that affordable. I mean, where is this going to stop? I mean, it really is a fun. It really puts corporate welfare on steroids. It's already a big problem, the corporate government, and now this is just takes to another level.
Kevin, we have to do another break here. Let's talk when we come back. What would make sense in terms of developing and implementing single payer in this country, as far-fetched as that may seem right now. Stay with us. We're talking with Kevin Zeese, author and activist, about the issue of single payer versus ACA. Stay with us. I'm Mike Molloy.
Watts of free speech. It's Mike Molloy.
25 before the hour. This hour is being sponsored by Philip Holbrook. We're talking with Kevin Zeese, author, activist, etc. Before we get to that, what next? If not ACA, a couple of comments here. Obamacare allows states to set up their own single-payer systems, and at least two states are doing so. This has been illegal up until now. And as my correspondent's writing here, as long as Republicans can't kill this provision of the law, we will come to single-payer the same way Canada did with the provinces that initially broke away and went for single-payer. What about that, Kevin?
Well, unfortunately, no state has to have a single-payer program. The best law in the country is Vermont's. They marketed it as a single-payer, used all the single-payer rhetoric, but in the end, it was not a single-payer program, and they couldn't put in place a single-payer program because federal law got in the way. And, in fact, the law is getting weaker rather than stronger so far. I hope that changes, and I hope that they do get to a single-payer.
The ACA doesn't provide for states to set up their
own. No, it doesn't. And what they do is they allow by you have to set up the exchange in 2014, and then in 2017 it allows you to opt out if you provide equal coverage. So they really, that's a really nice trick to make the state spend all that money to set up the new program and then let them, you know, opt out after they've already pulled out resources in the new program. So obviously very few states will do. Now, Vermont has tried to set up a single-payer program, but they're not anywhere. It's not one. It is the best state program in the country. So the intention was good, but it does not, is not one. But your writer is right. That is how Canada got there. It started actually, you know, locally, then grew to a province, and then grew nationally after it was successful in the province. And so that would be a great thing. And there are states, people that are trying to move that in states, but it's really tough to do. Federal law has lots of blockages. But single payer is nowhere mentioned or anything like single payer is mentioned anywhere in Obama's law. They did a good job of keeping that out.
All right. What would be the most effective most efficient, if that word can still be used where it concerns government here, but the most effective way to either begin the process to single payer or put it in play as quickly as possible? How is that possible given the absolute death grip that corporate America has on U.S. government?
Well, that's really why we went into the Occupy movement, because what we saw in healthcare, and, you know, Margaret Flowers, who you mentioned, is a doctor and a single-payer advocate, and she saw in healthcare that we ran into the same blocks that every other issue runs into, and that's corporate power, the power of the, you know, concentrated wealth trumping the people's preferences. The people have favored single-payer for 10 years by 60% or more consistently. Even if you call it socialized medicine, people favor it by 60%. Call it Medicare for All, it even gets higher numbers. So we really have to, if we succeed on healthcare, it means we're succeeding on the bigger issue of breaking the grip of corporate power. I think what will happen best, most quickly on single payers, if the court rules correctly, that the mandate is unconstitutional. I'd love it to leave the rest intact. You know, because that other part, the regulation is constitutional. Regulating any industry is constitutional. Mm-hmm. And you can do that, you know, for pre-existing illnesses, for the youth, all those issues you mentioned earlier. Those are all legal. I was really interested that Obama's, the attorney for the government, said that, no, it's all or nothing. If you don't take the mandate, we don't want anything else to pass either. It really showed to me they were on the side of protecting the industry and not the people, because they could have taken the opposite vision. They could have said, well, get rid of the mandate, but leave intact the rest of the law so we can improve health care. But no, they didn't do that.
I think
the court rules are unconstitutional, and we take one step. We remove two words, over 65, from the Medicare law. Now, that will not produce a perfect law, but that would be on the right path. Then we could spend the next year or two perfecting that law, because Medicare needs to be improved. But you just take out those two words, over 65, and you have health care for all. You have an efficient system, because Medicare is about 2 to 3% overhead, compared to the insurance industry is about 17% overhead. And so you're immediately saving money. All those tax subsidies to the insurance industry, to the employers, to provide health care to the employees, all that can go into funding Medicare for all. We'll save money right away. Then we can debate how to make health care better.
Let me ask you this. Doesn't it creep you out just a little bit, because it does me, to find myself, certainly in my case anyway, emotionally, on the side of those who want to see this declared unconstitutional? And I hate that, because I have zero respect for the current makeup of the Supreme Court, the five.
I know, it's so weird.
And to walk around among the teabaggers and those people that were in front of the Supreme Court the other day, and listen to them, screaming about, the Supreme Court's gotta strike this down. And I'm walking through that thinking to myself, you know, this should not be the issue. The issue should be, single payer, where there is a tax to pay for it. Nobody has to sign up, sign in, sign out. It's just a birthright. But doesn't that creep you out? Yourself in that position?
To say Justice Roberts makes a lot of sense, and to say Justice Kennedy makes a lot of sense is very unusual for words to come out of my mouth, that's for sure. But I really do fear this corporate government that they're putting in place. and solidifying with this law. I think
all right,
it's a
what
major
are the,
step.
What are the chances, given that, Kevin, given the fact that there already is a stranglehold from corporate America, and given the fact that that stranglehold, I think you and I could agree, is going to be damn near impossible to, you know, to peel those fingers away from the throat of this country, what chance then is there to remove those two words? What chance
I
is
think
there?
It's I think it's inevitable. It's going to happen. I do think that the stranglehold of corporate power is going to be destroyed. I really I'm confident that just like when women who couldn't vote got the right to vote, just like Jim Crow was ended, just like gays who couldn't advertise in the Village Voice in 1970, the Village Voice, mm-hmm. they couldn't advertise, you know, a gay rights organization. Now they're getting married. I mean, just like all those things that couldn't happen happened, we're going to end corporate power. We are going to shift power to the people. It is going to happen. It is inevitable. We are in the midst of a great turning in this country and in this world over energy, over climate, over the wealth divide, over poverty, over war. All this stuff is coming to an end. It's not working. And it's and we're going to move from a capitalist, competitive, dog-eat-dog, winner-gets-all world to a cooperative, working together, community solving problem world. That is where we're going. And we're fighting to get there. People who are profiting from the old world don't want to give it up. But it is inevitable. That is where it's going. Everything is pointing there. We just have to get there as quickly as we can to save as many lives as we can, to protect the environment as best we can, and really, you know, create the world we want to see. I think it's inevitable, Mike. I really do. I hadn't felt that way for a while, but the more I look at the overall picture and step back from just this one issue, so much is coming to an end.
I agree, and I'm right there with you emotionally, just about every other way that I can associate myself with that idea. But here's the part that concerns me, and I'm not exaggerating when I say that some nights I lay awake thinking about this. To go from where we are to where you and I and millions of us would like to see us be is going to require creative destruction. Do you think do you think this society can withstand that?
I think we have no choice. I mean, it might be we may end up seeing six countries rather than one in the end. Who knows? I mean, I think everything, all changes are around the table. But I think that kind of creative destruction is inevitable. I do think you're right. It's a scary process. Change is scary in our own personal lives, and it's even scarier on our societal level. You know, whenever we went through the changes I mentioned before on women getting the right to vote, on unions being formed, on ending slavery and ending Jim Crow, it's messy. But it is inevitable. It's going to happen. And I think what we can do, I think that's what's hopeful to me about Occupy, is that it is a mobilized people standing together in a nonviolent effort to make this change. If we can make a mass movement like that, that sticks to nonviolence, we can make this change much easier than, you know, I think you and I both have the same fear, much easier than we fear. Not going to be easy, but we got to build it. We're at the beginning part. Right now, Occupy, I think, is still a fringe group, a fringe movement with the potential to become a mass movement. But it's got a lot of steps away. If you look at, I sent you a copy a couple hours ago of our newspaper, Occupied Washington Post, which is a special edition for the national occupation of Washington, D.C. And people can see it online, nowdc.org. If you look at the content of the social forum, the controlling the corporation conference, the direct action trainings, we are lifting the Occupy to another level of really impressive activism. I think that we are just at the beginning of a major mass movement that could take 10 years and do incredible things. It could also happen much quicker, by the way. We could see the Constitution, the court rule correctly on the Constitution. No, you can't force people to buy a corporate product. We can see the Occupy and the public say we need a healthcare, we need to solve the healthcare problem. We could have take those two words out next year. You know, in 2013, those two words could disappear from Medicare, and it's no longer just over 65. We do that, we are on a big change forward more quickly than we expected, and that could happen.
I
on the other hand, it could be a long marathon too.
Well, one way or the other, I don't think there's any question. Kevin, it's always good to talk to you. Our paths will cross again soon, I'm sure.
Good. Thanks a lot.
All right, sir. Take care.
Right. Bye.
Take care. Kevin Zeese, author, activist. We'll be right back.
Rearrange the way you think. Hesitate, lose control, and you will sink. Think fast, think for yourself. Don't let the world beat your own heart because it is so. It's so full of greed because it is so. It's so, so much need for independence, solidarity, unity, and prosperity.
Gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the flying monkey right with Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by Philip Holbrook. Thank you, Philip. If you listen to this program on a regular basis, you know that I certainly agree with Kevin Zeese's position on this issue of healthcare, but also the issue of corporate power. We've talked about this many, many times. It's not like I and perhaps a lot of people listening to this program have to be convinced that the fact that our system has been totally corrupted by money, and the money has come from corporations, that's a given. The thing that bothers me, and I'm just trying to get to this with Kevin right towards the end of the conversation, is the sense that I have that people are so entrenched in their inability to understand what's really going on. I want to say ignorance, I guess. That the resistance for this change, this creative destruction and the rebuilding of a society that we've talked about, a lot of people talk about, the resistance to that is going to result in a lot of destruction in this country. And I hate to see that because this is so unnecessary, you know. It's just so, so unnecessary. But ignorance and fear and bigotry is pumped into the heads of millions of people day in and day out by right-wing media. It just never stops. Never. Even when a 17-year-old kid is gunned down in Florida, crazy people like Michelle Malkin and Glenn Beck and the rest of these people who are hell-bent on utter fascism taking over this country. I don't know where they see their position in fascism. Useful idiots like a Michelle Malkin or a Glenn Beck under a fascist state would go up against the wall first. First! I can't figure it out. It's just totally, totally beyond me. But because so much of this country, and let's face it, I'm not talking about you, but so many people in this country have become absolute, I want to say cowards, but let me rephrase it, live in a perpetual state of fear. Afraid to do anything because corporate America has so beaten people down. You know, you step out of your comfort zone and go someplace in the middle of your city or near an expressway, and you look at all the things going on, the cars whizzing by, the trucks, the trains, people going to work, office buildings, this, and lights on, and so on and so forth. And it all looks so, like, not necessarily normal, but it doesn't look like you're watching people who are living in absolute fear. And they would never tell you they're living in fear. But afraid of everything. I'm afraid I'm going to lose my unemployment. Afraid I'm going to lose my health insurance. Afraid I'm going to lose my house. Afraid I'm going to lose my job. I'm afraid to say anything or do anything. I'm afraid of any kind of change whatsoever. I don't want any of this. It's hell trying to get health insurance. So I got this Blue Cross Blue Shield policy, and it's got a $5,000 deductible, and it doesn't cover anything really. But if I get a heart attack or cancer, you know, maybe, just maybe, unless they find it's a pre-existing condition, maybe I'll have some kind of coverage. At least I can get into a hospital. They can't throw you out once you're in, right? Wrong. But this fear that just permeates everything. And what happens when people get afraid? Either deliberately or inadvertently, Obama talked about it during the campaign for his first presidency. They turned to their guns and Bibles. It doesn't make any difference what their religious texts are. That's where they go. Look at the Muslim world. Look at the Jews, the Orthodox Jews in Israel. Look at Christian fundamentalists in this country. They go to their guns and their Bibles, their holy books. You know, it's one thing, and we do this a lot on this program, to sit here and scratch our heads and wonder, how is it that people are so willing to consciously and deliberately work against their own best interests? Maybe the answer to that is the overarching emotion or pressure that forces them to do that is just utter fear. Complete and total fear. Promoted by, promulgated by, originating with this right-wing media that is filthy. Michelle Malkin and Rush Limbaugh and the rest of these slime. Just slime. And they do it for sport. They do it for sport. And corporate America supports them. And millions of people tune in to the pig man and to the rest of these destroyers. So I guess that's it. Fear. As long as Limbaugh's on the air, the cowards have somebody they can cluster around. Protect me, Rush. Tell me what to think, Rush. Tell me what to do, Rush. I'm afraid, Rush. Of course, I never say that to you, Rush. I'm real ballsy like you are. Oh, yeah. Hey, listen. Let's kick some ass. Let's stomp a homeless person. Let's gun down a black teenager unarmed. Yeah, let's do that. Come on, Rush! But underneath that, they're terrified. Right-wingers. Terrified. Terrified of their own shadows. Terrified of their neighbors. Terrified of any kind of cooperation. Terrified, like I don't know, like what? Just cowardly. Every single one of them. Now, how to penetrate that fear and say to these right wingers, "Listen, you know, you can step out of your fear and live like a human being if you just open your eyes." Think of this. The hour. This is the Malloy program. It's being sponsored this hour by Alice in Arkansas at Healin' Hollers. Healin-Hollers.com. You know who she is. Alice is sponsoring this hour, and Here's her message. The ticks, gnats, and other annoying flying and stinging insect critters are smarter than the climate deniers. The insects know the planet is warming. And they're happily feasting on flesh in March this year. So it's time to stock up on Heal and Holler Summer Scent Insect Repellent and Chickweed Salve. Just click on the link on Mike's webpage for the spring special. Thanks, Alice. Listen, that Summer Scent Insect Repellent, if you're going to spend any time outside, take it from me. I can be standing in the middle of a football stadium, and if there's one mosquito and 50,000 people, that mosquito will find me. I don't know why. But I tried some of the stuff, I think it was two summers ago, when I tried some of Alice's Summer Scent Insect Repellent. Oh. And it doesn't have DEET in it. It doesn't have the chemical stuff that you find in Deepwoods Off and some of those other ones. Granted, DEET is effective. It also will rot your insides and, I don't know, give you all sorts of diseases and cancer and death and destruction. For God's sake, don't put it on your kids. But Alice has Summer Scent Insect Repellent. Get it. I'm telling you. I'm serious. Just do this. Do this. I don't know how she does it, Kathy. I have no idea how she makes this stuff. Elves. Huh? Elves? Is that what it is? Come out of those hills down there in Arkansas. Why is Arkansas spelled as if it were Arkansas? Never been able to figure that one out. Tim in L.A. sent this to me. Michelle Malkin should be happy that lefties exist. Why? Because her parents were illegals, making her an anchor baby. And speaking about Malkin, really? Is that true, Tim? And speaking about Malkin, Tim writes, did you know the name Malkin means, okay, let's see here. It's from British dialect. It says a scarecrow, a ragged puppet, or grotesque effigy, a mop, especially one made from a bundle of rags and used to clean out a baker's oven, a cat, a hare, H-A-R-E. Really? Of course, that's her husband's name, but she really is a screeching, nasty right-winger, isn't she? Just, I swear to God, she is. A complete self-hating female. Totally. Totally. Unbelievable. We have a moment with Bob coming up after, I guess after the break at the bottom of the hour. Another moment with God. With God? With Bob. The title is Designed to Fail. Interesting piece. I was reading it earlier. What else do I want to touch on tonight? Tom in 29 Palms, California, sent this in last night. Didn't get a chance to share it with you. Anti-rape as anti-war is the subject line. Tom writes, Mike, I came up with a countermeasure to the religious brain disease that has gripped our nation. Religious brain disease. Boy, is that the truth. Why not let's put all sexual crimes up for grabs and prosecution, especially rape. Let's focus on a national RIP rape campaign, the way the nut jobs focus on homosexuality and other BS like abortion and contraception. A new meme, RIP, report, identify, prosecute, rape. RIP, rape, report, identify, prosecute. Since rape is up in the military, for example, 30% from last year, it means that there are at least 5,000 reported rapes a year in the military, which means 5,000 rapists and at least 15,000 in command who knew and kept the secret, complicit in the crime of rape. That right there is enough to shut down the war-making machine if that many were prosecuted and lost their command. Also, those who keep quiet about rape are also the ones who are prompting the president to enact the Espionage Act of 1917 as a way of putting away whistleblowers and journalists for life, for telling the truth. So as the whistle is blown on rape, the entire culture of secrecy will begin to dismantle, and war-making will become impossible. Once those lies and liars have been exposed, then there is a political quality to an anti-rape vanguard in that it will polarize politics into those who are, quote, for rape, which will be all the Republicans and Christians, and those who are against rape, in much the same way as the right has used abortion and guns. And most importantly, it is something that can empower us as a culture of victims to fight back. It's sort of like a national Occupy morality. It is something that can unite all women and men who have a conscience, and is something we can all do with conviction. Just a thought. Tom in 29 Palm, that's a good idea. Report, identify, and prosecute rape. Boy, the Catholic Church's structure would collapse, wouldn't it? Thanks, Tom. From Prairie 2. The outcome can't be guaranteed. Some estimates are now available on the practical consideration of Israel's aspirations of attacking Iran's newest uranium enrichment facility to penetrate to the reported depth of this installation through 300 feet of solid rock. The largest weapon Israel is reported to have is a 5,000 pound bunker buster bomb, and it would take a minimum of 6 direct hits. That is, hitting the bottom of the original hole if the first one is on target. Only Israel's F-15s are capable of carrying a bomb this size, and it would be overloaded in the sense of becoming an easy target for any defense Iran puts up. To make that many direct hits would require a minimum of 75 attempts. Israel only has 85 F-15s in all configurations, some of which are set up as interceptors and probably can't carry such large bombs for the distance required. Plus, they would need in-flight refueling from a very limited fleet of aging air tankers. The biggest problem that Israel has in this adventure is the Syrian-Russian air defense system that is fully capable of detecting one F-15, let alone a 400-plane strike force of all types of aircraft that would be required to take on all of Iran's installations at once. Iran won't be caught off guard and will mount its own formidable defense. Israel would likely lose a significant portion of its air force in the attempt and still not achieve its goal. The U.S. Air Force, which is capable of delivering much larger bombs, says it would be a fool's errand to attempt such an attack, even for the U.S. So any fantasy talk of Israel attacking Iran is strictly for political ends. It benefits the right in Israel, and it benefits the right wing here, as it helps drive up oil prices. This strategy requires that the price of oil doesn't collapse before the election. With demand already depressed by past high prices that led to a move toward more efficient use of oil products, and combined with lowered consumption from the still depressed economy, the price bubble could burst any time. The corporate media keep repeating the talking point that Obama's release of oil from the strategic reserve last year didn't have much effect. The actual numbers have, of course, a liberal bias. It was universally accepted that gas would be $6 a gallon by Labor Day, and this didn't happen. While gas is approaching the peak of last year's price, the supply on hand is even greater. The longer Obama waits to release, the more dramatic the result. But with Obama's current lead over Romney in the states that matter for the Electoral College, he could start spending all his time at the ranch in Crawford. Oh, wait. Obama actually takes his job seriously, so he won't. Too bad this work ethic doesn't guarantee a good outcome for the nation. Things are that bad. PrairieNumeral2.com.
For Radical Talk Radio, it's Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. After the next break, we're going to have a moment with Bob. Speaking of Bob, just got a quick email from him. He writes, it's in reference to the, have you been watching your local news or network news television? The rising hysteria about gasoline prices. It's fascinating to watch this. I'll talk about this a little bit later tonight too, but you know, Americans have been spoiled for years. We've had gas prices so low in this country since forever, while the rest of the world was paying a price that made a little more sense. But the hysteria that you find on television news about, oh my God, $5 a gallon. AAA says that the average price across the country right now is $3.92 a gallon. And I heard my local news people tonight saying, you may be paying more than $4 a gallon now, but what they were trying to say is this. Hold on to your ass! You don't know what's coming! $5 a gallon. Oh no. No, please God, not that. Oh no. Bob writes, imagine gas prices hit $5.83 a gallon. Whatever will people do? Will the populace snap and run amok with their collective hair on fire? Up here north of Jesus Land, gas is around $5.83 a gallon. And the response? It's been to, you know, go about their daily lives. Daily, I'm so happy we live 141.2 miles north of where we used to. Bob. Oh, my God. I can remember years ago, remember, Kathy, we talked about this very issue, and my point was gasoline should rise to maybe, you know, $6 a gallon, which would hurt me, it would hurt everybody, until we adjusted. And the way we would adjust is we would stop buying cars until the automakers provided us with cars which they're trying to do now, that got 40, 50, 60 miles a gallon, hybrid or not, which is very doable, which they would do. And then all of a sudden, the relative cost of gasoline would sink to about, you know, $1.50. But when I listen to these freaks like Romney and the rest of these people, and again, this is one of the things I'm going to bring up later. But I listened to them blaming Barack Obama for high gasoline prices. Either these Republicans are so stupid, or they think the people who are going to vote for them are so stupid, or a combination of both. I think it's both. But no matter how many reports indicate that oil and gas production in this country is higher than it's been for decades, that the country is awash in gasoline, it's being exported, we have so much of it, that oil prices are being manipulated by the commodities traders, and when it's not being manipulated, it's following the law of the jungle, and the prices are rising because China and India and Brazil are demanding gasoline, oil on an unprecedented level. But the Republican candidates for president understand their audience, their voters, the people are going to vote for them. The ignorant savages that slog around with their heads about 30 feet up their asses, convincing each other that Barack Obama is a Muslim from Kenya and that it's his fault. The gasoline is approaching $4 a gallon, or four and a quarter where you live, or $4.50. Oh my God! How can you right wingers be so monumentally catastrophically stupid and manipulable. Why not let a nice progressive or liberal manipulate you, since apparently you want to be manipulated? That seems to be you're incapable of independent thought. Why not let people who would lead you to an area where your best interest would be served, let them manipulate you, instead of being manipulated by people who are leading you to a point where collective suicide is going to be your only way out? What is wrong with you? Well, never mind. When we come back, a moment with Bulb.
Secret.
25 before the hour. And this hour is being sponsored once again by Alice in Arkansas at Heel and Hollers. Thank you, Alice. It's Heelan-Hollers.com, or you can go to my website, go to MikeMalloy.com, and just click on her her ad there, her link. And here's the message. The ticks, gnats, and other annoying flying and stinging insect critters are smarter than the climate deniers. The insects know the planet is warming, and they're happily feasting on flesh in March this year. So it's time to stock up on Heel and Holler Summer Scent Insect Repellent and Chickweed Salve. Those are two separate products, by the way. Just click on the link on Mike's webpage for the spring special. And I'm telling you again, if you spend any time outside and have any dealings with mosquitoes, you've got to get this summer scent insect repellent. I know how Alice could become a billionaire, and that is just get this stuff in CVS or Walgreens. Man.
All natural.
Huh?
It's all natural.
It's all natural, yeah. Yeah, it works so just perfectly. All right, I hear something in the distance. It sounds like... It is a ukulele? It's time once again for A Moment with Bob. Brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. Tonight's Moment with Bob is entitled Designed to Fail. Hey Mike, Trayvon Martin was killed last month for the same reason Eugene Williams died 93 years ago in Chicago. A white man decided Eugene Williams was where a black man should be, so he killed, shouldn't be, so he killed him. The white man was tried for Williams' death and acquitted. Trayvon Martin died because the United States of America is still one evil son of a bitchin' country to live in if you're not white. There are about a dozen Holocaust museums in the United States. The largest is United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. It is dedicated to, quote, helping leaders and citizens of the world confront hatred, prevent genocide, promote human dignity, and strengthen democracy, end quote. The most visited exhibit at this museum is made up of more than 900 artifacts, 70 video monitors, and 4 theaters showing historic film footage and eyewitness testimonies. Nazi Germany was one evil son of a bitchin' country to live in if you were Jewish. 9,000 miles from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum is the American War Atrocities Museum in Ho Chi Minh City, Vietnam. This museum comprises a series of 8 themed rooms in several buildings. Exhibits include graphic photographs covering the effects of Agent Orange and other chemical defoliant sprays, the use of napalm and phosphorus bombs, and atrocities such as the My Lai massacre. Civilian casualties of the Vietnam War were 2 million in the North and 2 million in the South. Vietnamese military casualties were 1.1 million killed, 600,000 wounded, and 300,000 missing in action. According to the CIA's own figures, the illegal invasion and bombing of Cambodia took another 600,000 lives. As Nick Turse wrote in his forthcoming book about the history of U.S. war crimes in Vietnam, titled Kill Anything That Moves, quote, no one will ever know how many U.S. perpetrated massacres took place in Vietnam, nor how many hamlets were decimated by bombings, nor the number of villages laid waste by artillery strikes, nor will there ever be an accurate count of the people psychologically injured, maimed, or killed, end quote. Here is just one horrific footnote in a hidden history of the Vietnam War. 18 U.S. soldiers from the elite volunteer 45-man Tiger Force unit of the U.S. Army's 101st Airborne Division committed war crimes ranging from torture, rape, mutilation of bodies, and murdering over 100 unarmed civilians. Not one of the soldiers, even those still on active duty at the time of the Army's investigation, was ever court-martialed in connection with the heinous crimes. Moreover, 6 suspected war criminals were allowed to resign from military service during the criminal investigation, specifically to avoid prosecution. Approximately 6 million people were killed in Southeast Asia because the United States is one evil son of a bitchin' country. Period. The Nazis and the German people were held accountable for their war crimes at the end of the war, but there were no Nuremberg-type trials at the end of the war in Vietnam. We did not prosecute the monsters who made war on the people of Vietnam, so they were free to take us into Iraq. The United States has taken a pass on being held accountable for anything it has done for the past 236 years. How many treaties did the United States government break with American Indians? Every single one. The world's longest Holocaust in the history of mankind took place in this country. Holocaust expert David Cesarani stated that, quote, in terms of the sheer numbers killed, the Native American genocide exceeds that of the Holocaust, end quote. There is no accountability in the American empire. We just saw, right before our very eyes, the Bush-Cheney regime lie the United States into war against Iraq, where 1.2 million Iraqis and 4,486 Americans have been killed to date. The suggestion that the Bush-Cheney regime should be held accountable and prosecuted for these murders has been dismissed by the Attorney General, United States attorneys, and every relevant district attorney in the country. The criminals running the financial sector of the United States colluded with their political lackeys and pulled off the biggest heist of all time. As of today, the punishment for melting down the world's economies and throwing millions of people out of work and out of their homes is billions of dollars worth of bonuses instead of penalties in prison time. The political system regularly serves up a choice of 2 slightly different flavors of capitalism. Each candidate is dedicated to moving the fascistic agenda forward and is in complete agreement that any real accountability is to be avoided at all costs. Without accountability, there can be no justice. It's as simple as that. It doesn't make any difference who we vote for. It doesn't matter if we are progressive or conservative or commies. If there is no accountability built into the system, tweaking this or adjusting that is completely useless. It doesn't work. It can't possibly work. Without accountability, the system is designed to fail. There will be more Trayvon Martins murdered. There will be more illegal invasions and wars. There will be more financial devastation gutting our future until we hold the racists, the warmongers, and the robber barons accountable for their crimes. A possible solution to all this was written 236 years ago. Quote, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is a right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness." End quote. But if I understand it, if we believe the previous paragraph and act upon it, we'll be breaking laws signed by George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Regards, Bob. Another Moment with Bob, brought to you by your friends at Offshore Drilling. And a new sponsor, Onshore Drilling. What else do we have? I have a good friend, Bob Kincaid. Some of you know him from his web radio program, The Horn, Head On Radio Network, H-O-R-N. A lot of the people who listen to this program also listen to Bob Kincaid. And I spent some time with him Monday and Tuesday in Washington. As a matter of fact, had Bob not been there with his computer genius, we probably, Kathy, would have wound up broadcasting music. It got pretty bad. But between Tara Dactyl and Bob Kincaid, we managed to put things together. Had a chance to talk to Bob a little bit about permit for a mine in West Virginia. I want to talk to you about it when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This hour has been sponsored by Alice in Arkansas at Healing Hollers. And she has a message. The ticks, gnats, and other annoying flying and stinging insect critters are smarter than the climate deniers. The insects know the planet is warming, so they're happily feasting on flesh in March this year. March. So it's time to stock up on Healing Hollers summer scent insect repellent and some chickweed salve. Just click on the link on my webpage, MikeMalloy.com, for the spring special. And if you don't get anything else this spring or summer to keep the bugs away, try some of this. Seriously, try some of the summer scent insect repellent. Just damn amazing stuff. Bob Kincaid is an activist, as well as being a broadcaster and many other things, an activist in West Virginia, trying to save the entire state. This is a guy who puts himself out there repeatedly, constantly. And he has, if you haven't listened to his radio program online, you should check him out every night. Head on Radio Network. Headonradionetwork.com.org. You'll find it. Just do it. Anyway, New York Times editorial the other day, the Obama administration's decision last year to revoke a permit for the huge mine in West Virginia inspired hope that mountaintop mining, which has caused immense environmental damage across Appalachia, would soon be coming to an end. Now, a federal district court judge in the District of Columbia has ruled that the EPA exceeded its legal authority in blocking the mine. The Obama administration has got to appeal this. The Clean Water Act is on its side, as are the people of West Virginia. And as the Times points out, mountaintop mining is a highly efficient and hugely destructive form of strip mining that blasts apart mountain ridges to expose the coal seams underneath. The resulting rubble is then dumped into the valleys and streams below. Thousands of miles of streams in Appalachian coal country have already been obliterated using this technique. The Spruce No. 1 mine project in Logan County, West Virginia, that's what we're talking about here, would have covered 2,278 acres and ruined six more miles of high-quality streams. The project received a final permit to proceed from the Army Corps of Engineers in 2007. Lawsuits followed. And in January 2011, the EPA revoked their permit on grounds that the mine would cause unacceptable environmental damage. The EPA had blocked Army Corps projects before. But this time, this was the first time it had rescinded an approved mining permit and was part of the administration's broader campaign to limit mountaintop mining by reviewing old permits and tightening standards for new ones. Ah, but along comes Judge Amy Berman Jackson, who said that the EPA had resorted to what she called magical thinking in claiming that the Clean Water Act gives it the power to rescind a permit. But Section 404 of the law does give the agency broad authority to protect water quality, including the withdrawal of permits whenever it determines that they will have an unacceptable adverse effect on the environment. And the EPA rightly interpreted these words to mean that it had clear authority to claw back a badly misguided decision that would do even more damage to West Virginia's streams and landscape. Hopefully a higher court will read it that way as well. But it's astonishing, isn't it, Truth Seekers, that the court system in this country, well, it's not astonishing. This has been a slow process that started with Reagan, and it has continued inexorably towards what we now have, a judiciary in this country that is almost, not quite, but almost so stacked in favor of right-wing corporatism, right-wing fascism, whatever you want to call it, fascism in general, corporatism in general, neo-fascism, I don't care what you call it, but the courts are stacked by neo-fascists. You have any doubt? Look at the decision that the United States Supreme Court handed down on December 12th, 2000. And we've talked about this many times before. At that moment, the will of the people to determine, as it says in the preamble, that the power to govern will be derived from the people to be governed. That disappeared on that day, that December in 2000. This is what Kevin Cease was talking about. This is what Bob Alexander's talking about. Bob Kincaid's talked about it. You've talked about it. We've talked about it on this program. It just goes on and on. The discussion, frankly, for me, is becoming a bit redundant. And I just wonder, with what Kevin and I were talking about earlier this evening, I wonder how long it will take before the American people realize just how deeply and severely the right wing in this country and the corporatists have wounded the whole idea of self-government, of, by, and for the people. And once that realization sinks in, what are we going to do? All right, stick around. We, when we come back, what have we got here? Oh, yeah, you know, Obama gave a speech this morning about the oil industry. And we've got some coverage of that, sort of, not really, but stick around. Also, well, just a bunch of stuff. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. This hour is being sponsored by some L.A. Truth Seekers. There you go, some L.A. Truth Seekers. Here's the message. The future is here. Please consider supporting all independent voices. Besides Mike, please investigate others such as the Progressive Radio Network and Blog Talk Radio. Again, the future is here now. Thank you, L.A. Truth Seekers. This program sometimes depresses the hell out of even me, so I thought I would just inject a little comic relief here. Dave Mustaine, you all know who Dave Mustaine is. Well, okay, you have to be of a certain mindset or mindless set or whatever. Dave Mustaine, the front man for Megadeth, one of the founders of Megadeth. The heavy metal band that was put together, I don't know what, 30 years ago? Long time ago. Anyway, Dave Mustaine was being interviewed on a Canadian talk show recently, and he said that he really doubts. I really doubt whether or not Barack Obama was born in the United States, and he really likes. Here, try some of this. Republican presidential hopeful Rick Santorum. Yes, he did. This is what happens when you bang your head enough times against, you know, anything that offers resistance over a 30-year period, right? Mustaine sat down with George Strombolopoulos, host of The Hour, and explained that he has, quote, a lot of questions about Obama. But certainly not where he was born. I know he was born somewhere else than America. The host, Strombolopoulos, then asked him if he, Dave Mustaine, was a birther. Mustaine said, and then Strombolopoulos pushed the point. Well, then you are a birther. During the interview, Mustaine was also asked rhetorically what would be the point of questioning Obama's birthplace. And You know, I mean, after all, if he was born out of the country, where was he born, Dave? And he continued to endorse Rick Santorum. Mustaine said about Santorum, you know, he could really, wait a minute. He really could be a cool president, kind of like JFK. Santorum could be like JFK. Yeah, you know. You know what I mean? Type that, you know. Of Mitt Romney, he added, you know, George Soros came out and said, Mitt Romney's just like Obama. So, you know, what do you got there? You got Obama's mentor saying, wait a minute. Let's see. You got Obama's mentor saying that Mitt Romney is just like him. And he's leading the polls now. What time is it? Damn, man. This is some real beep. I mean, what? And with that, Strombolopoulos of the Canadian talk show The Hour had to call for Dave Mustaine's handlers. Now, Dave Mustaine, you know who he is. He was originally a member of Metallica when they formed in 1981, but he got fired from Metallica. Fired due to drinking, drug use, violent behavior, and personality conflicts with James Hetfield, Lars Ulrich, and original Metallica bassist Ron McGovney. 2 months after being fired, Mustaine and bassist Dave Ellefson formed Megadeth in L.A. Dave Mustaine later said, you know, after getting fired from Metallica, all I remember was I wanted blood. You know, I wanted to be faster and heavier than them. Really, you know? Man, that's some real beep! I saw this in Rolling Stone, and I saw this. What? This guy. Oh, yeah. Let's all pay attention to what Dave Mustaine thinks about anything. I mean, anything. Yeah, Obama's a brother. Jeez. Okay. Every once in a while, you just have to laugh or you go crazy. Obama, Mr. President, gave a speech this morning. Did you catch it on the way oil companies are ripping off everybody and always have? And it's time to end the oil subsidies, the tax subsidies to these freaks. You know, it's just madness. Big oil has been a negative influence on this country for generations. I think everybody knows that. Who was the president who tried to break up or to succeed in breaking up Standard Oil? Standard Oil is back together now. ExxonMobil is the old Standard Oil. The Rockefeller Energy Trust that was so destructive to the country. But certainly built an awful lot of fortunes. Now, a lot of people say, well, what do you mean destructive? It was oil. You know, oil that built this great society that we have here. Yeah? I'm sorry. I tend to have to disagree with that vehemently. It was oil, and it continues to be oil, that is destroying not just us, of course, but everything everywhere. It's oil that causes death and destruction. The greed heads like Bush and Cheney who invade another country to steal their oil, and the result is a million people dead. Has Cheney or Bush been indicted yet? Anybody? No? They're just going to walk free, aren't they? And now Cheney You know, Cheney shows up with a heart in a bag the other night and, you know, has his daughter tell them what I have in this box. You know, tells his daughter, did you hear me? Liz, do it now. It's getting harder to breathe. My dad wants a heart transplant. We got one. But they haven't been indicted and tried and convicted and sent to prison for the rest of their lives and probably never will. But oil has been the driving force between death and the driving force of death and destruction and Middle East chaos and God knows how many people in Africa, in Latin America, in the Far East, in South Asia, how many millions upon countless millions of people have died and continue to die, and the pollution and the destruction. Sometime do a Google on Nigeria oil. That's all. Just do that. And then read 1 or 6 or 20 or 5,000 of the million or so articles that will pop up. Just do it. Do Texaco and what was it, Peru or was it Ecuador? Just do it. So Obama was out there giving a speech this morning. Well, coincidentally, Elizabeth Colbert, writing in the current issue of New Yorker magazine, has an interesting little piece I'm going to share with you when we come back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy. Past the hour. Okay, as Elizabeth Colbert at New Yorker Magazine has in the comment section, this current issue, she's pointing out the last week. Remember when Mitt Romney, who obviously is going to be the Republican nominee, regardless of what Megadeth frontman Twiddlehead says, excuse me, wait a second. Okay. Romney, last week, insisted that President Obama fire three of his cabinet members. He demanded the immediate removal of Energy Secretary Stephen Chu, Interior Secretary Ken Salazar, and ahead of the EPA, Lisa Jackson. Right? Fire them! Fire them now! Now, according to Romney, the three have spent the past few years carrying out a secret plan to raise the price of gasoline at the pump. That's right. Now, according to Romney, only by firing the so-called gas tax trio, Romney told all this to Fox News, of course, and you can understand why. If he would have gone on a real radio network or television network or been interviewed by a real newspaper reporter, he would have, you know, stayed away from this and told another one of those jokes about his dad firing everybody. But on Fox News, you lie. That's exactly what Fox News is designed for. So, only by firing what he called the gas tax trio, Romney told Fox News, can President Obama demonstrate that he did not approve of this plan. Time for them to go, Romney said. What? Jesus God, This man is insane. And this is what the Republicans are going to... Oh, I can't wait. Can you imagine Obama and Romney in a head-to-head debate? It's going to make Kennedy Nixon look like... I don't know. The Romney Nixon character is going to be chopped into little chunks of hamburger meat. Or what do they call it? Pink slime. But anyway, Romney's remarks came, according to Elizabeth Colbert, again at New Yorker Magazine, Romney's remarks came just days after Louisiana's governor, Bobby Jindal, also on Fox. You notice a pattern? Accused the Obama administration of driving up the cost of gasoline in order to fulfill its, what Jindal called, the Obama's radical agenda. I wish one of these right-wing half-wits would show me, chapter and verse, what is radical about Obama's agenda? Are you kidding me? Obama is more of a corporatist than Jindal or Romney could ever hope to be. I digress. Anyway, Jindal said, quote, and I want you to see if you can guess how many lies are in here. This is what Jindal said. The reality is gasoline prices have doubled under this president. Highest prices for oil and gasoline in 150 years. 150 years? That would be back to what? 18, 19, 20, oh God. Jindal went on. People used to think it was because of incompetence from the Obama administration on energy. I think it's because of ideology. End quote, Bobby Jindal. Now, as far as reality goes, Jindal's characterization of gas prices is so far off the map as to render it just more Bobby Jindal. You know, too many shrimps in your morning coffee, Bobby. Crap. Prices were higher under George W. Bush in 2008 than they are now. But never mind. Remember who Jindal was talking to. The viewers of Fox, Rupert Murdoch's terror broadcast organization. So when you go on Fox, you say anything. And the more ridiculous, the better, because the bobbleheads will sit there. Study after study has proven this, too. The bobbleheads will sit there. That's right. We're not going to reelect him. That would be reneging. Okay. Now, Romney and Jindal both were, according to Elizabeth Colbert at The New Yorker, were echoing comments made by Newt Gingrich, who accused Obama of adhering to a radical ideology which wants to artificially raise the cost of energy. Right? That's Gingrich. You remember Newt Gingrich. He's about to exit stage right. And Gingrich was following Santorum, who back in February declared that Obama's energy policies are based on a, quote, phony ideology that elevates the earth above man. End quote. What? Elevates the earth above man. Jesus. Oh, stop. Stop. Where's the front man from Megadeth? Get back out here. Bring your bony ass back out here, dude. Come on. Ah! We'll be right back with more of a lot of gas.
You taught me paradise is in your mind. You know that there's hope. It doesn't cost a thing to smile. You don't have to pay to laugh. You better thank God for that. There's hope. It doesn't cost a thing to smile. You don't have to pay to laugh. You better thank God for that.
Time I turn on the TV,
there's hope.
Somebody's acting crazy,
there's hope.
You let it'll drive you crazy,
there's hope.
But I'm taking back my power today,
there's hope.
Gas prices, they just keep on rising,
there's hope.
The government.
Hey, truth seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
For when the dancers get to your moment, there's a move. Slide your walk, just
25 before the hour. This hour being sponsored by some L.A. truth seekers. Ta-da. And the truth seekers write, the future is here. Please consider supporting all independent voices. Besides Mike, please investigate others such as the Progressive Radio Network and Blog Talk Radio. Again, the future is here now, thanks to the L.A. Truth Seekers. Thanks a lot, folks. Okay. Gases. The Republicans blaming gas prices, blaming it on Obama. Obama gave a speech this morning that I'm sure did not register on any right-winger's radar. You know, Obama could say, guess what? I just received word that the rapture will happen at 3:15 this afternoon. And these morons would just continue picking boogers out of their noses and watching Fox. But anyway, as Elizabeth Colbert, writing New Yorker magazine, points out, like almost anything that the Republican candidates can manage to agree on, the Obama administration gas price hike conspiracy theory is 100% baloney. Elizabeth writes, the fakery begins with the theory's premise that the president could, if he wanted to, reduce the price of oil. Oil is a global commodity traded on a global market. Gasoline prices have risen. They're up roughly 15% since the start of the year because demand is climbing in countries like China and because of instability in the Middle East. And, of course, that prompts worries about supply. And, of course, then the speculators, the commodity speculators who sell long, sell short, make a profit. It doesn't make any difference to the speculators whether gas goes up or down, whether you starve or eat, whether your children go without having their teeth cleaned. They're going to make their money, period. But as Elizabeth points out, an idea doesn't have to be true. All this stuff about Obama and the gasoline price conspiracy, none of that has to be true or even convincing to be effective when you're dealing with right-wingers. It doesn't have to be anything except spoken. And as Elizabeth points out, the most rational policy options seem to have the hardest time getting heard. Well, yes. And when it comes to gas prices, it's been clear for, well, let's just say forever, that the cost of gasoline in America is actually too low. Kathy, how many times have we talked about that? Gasoline should be in this country $6 or $7 a gallon, minimum. Oh, I know, and I drive a pickup truck. Cheap gas generates sprawl. It generates traffic. It discourages the use of mass transit and the development of alternative fuels. It contributes to regional smog. It contributes to global climate change. The easiest and most obvious solution has been to raise the federal gas tax, which now stands at only 18 cents a gallon. I don't give a tinker's damn what these right-wing freaks say. 18 cents a gallon. And among economists, there's widespread report or widespread support for this idea. And one of them, Greg Mankiw, is that his name? A Harvard professor who happens to be the top advisor to Romney, writing in the New York Times earlier this year, Mankiw wrote, quote, economists who have added up all the externalities associated with driving conclude that a tax exceeding $2 a gallon makes sense. By taxing bad things more, we could tax good things less. That is Romney's tax advisor. That's your sketch, man. But anyway, last week, Elizabeth Colbert writes, as the Republicans continue to hammer away at the president on gas prices, Obama set off on an energy-themed cross-country tour. The tour, which coincided with a freakish March heat wave, included visits to a solar plant in Boulder City, Nevada, an oil field in Maljamar, New Mexico, and the site of a proposed pipeline in Cushing, Oklahoma. At each of these stops, Obama touted what he has taken to calling his all-of-the-above energy strategy. All-of-the-above energy strategy. Bad term, Mr. President. He said that he favored more domestic oil production and more solar power installations, a cleaner environment, a stronger economy. He made much of the fact that under his watch, domestic energy production has steadily increased and that enough new oil and gas pipeline has been laid to, quote, encircle the earth and then some, end quote. Yes, Mr. President, you're right. And did you know that, Truth Seeker? Gas production, gas and oil production in this country is skyrocketing. There is no shortage of gasoline. We are exporting it. Barack Obama has been friendly to the oil and gasoline industry to the point of almost being in bed with them. Oh, but he has a radical agenda. Oh, that's right. Those are right-wingers talking, and they're talking to other right-wingers who couldn't find their asses with both hands if they got up off the couch and moved away from the Rupert Murdoch terror broadcast organization, which they're incapable of doing. Obama said in Oklahoma, quote, since I took office, our dependence on foreign oil has gone down every single year. Last year, we imported 1 million fewer barrels per day than the year before. Hey, Limbaugh, hey, pig man, why don't you put that out there? Hey, Hannity, you little twit ass, why don't you say that? Hey, Malloy, why don't you stop screaming into the night? As Elizabeth Colbert points out, Obama sounded during that speech, as he generally does, thoughtful and reasonable, and the figures that he cited, for the most part, were accurate. Indeed, as the New York Times reported last week, dependency on foreign oil has fallen dramatically in recent years. But in terms of what matters most, the president's energy tour was a dispiriting affair. In the course of 2 days, he made 4 speeches. The number of times he mentioned the major impact of America's energy use, global warming, was zero. And in Oklahoma, he announced that he was expediting the construction of the southern leg of the Keystone XL pipeline. Now, that made no sense, except perhaps as political theater. A few months ago, he refused to allow construction of the pipeline's northern leg, precisely on the ground that Republicans were trying to push the permitting process. And lest we forget, the whole point of the Keystone Pipeline is to transport more dirty oil from Canada's tar sands, which goes to show that you can't be in favor of more pipelines and in favor of a cleaner environment at the same time. Who was it? Was it Einstein or Abe Snake who said you can't coincidentally prepare for and try to avoid war or nuclear war or something to that effect? Remember? Well, it applies to this subject also. So, a smorgasbord energy strategy, all of the above, is hardly any strategy at all. As Joe Rahm at the blog Climate Progress pointed out recently, quote, just a year ago, all of the above was actually a standard Republican talking point. So much so the Democrats routinely mocked it, end quote. And now it's become a line that Obama uses. Of course, what we need, as Elizabeth Colbert points out, and what the country has always needed, is an energy policy that, instead of pandering to Americans' sense of entitlement, would compel us to finally change our ways. In addition to a phased-in increase in the gas tax, this policy, if we were rational and sane in this country, would include a comprehensive economy-wide tax on carbon, or alternatively, a cap-and-trade system. Remember, I was pointing out last night, Australia and New Zealand have adopted both. There is no longer any debate in those two countries about the absolute need, if the human race, if the planet is to survive, to do these sorts of things. But we don't live there. We live here. Now, as it turns out, Mankiw isn't the only senior person in a Republican campaign to see the importance of a new policy. When Romney was governor of Massachusetts, he presided over the introduction of one of the country's first cap-and-trade programs for the 6 largest power plants in his state. And in his book, No Apology, he wrote, quote, higher energy prices would encourage energy efficiency, end quote. Really? The same guy who said that Obama should fire his 3 cabinet members because because they're in a conspiracy to raise the price of gasoline at the pump? Is this the same guy? Well, as Elizabeth Colbert points out, maybe once Romney secures the Republican Party nomination, he can etch-a-sketch his way back to reality and maybe even challenge Barack Obama to do the same thing. You think? This is just craziness. This is just insanity. If you want to read Elizabeth Colbert's piece, go to NewYorker.com. NewYorker.com. And find Elizabeth Colbert's piece, A Lot of Gas.
Who are the people making money?
Stack them chips.
While the rest of us are hurting.
Choose gas or food.
Big oil companies, their shareholders and friends.
Scratch my back.
Go ask those guys at Halliburton.
I'll scratch your
We can't afford our gasoline. The prices have become obscene. Unleaded regular, forget about supreme. We can't afford our gasoline. We can't afford our gasoline. The prices have become obscene. You'll get screwed at the pump, so bring your Vaseline. We can't afford our gasoline.
Sweeter things in your ear, but some.
Uh-oh, you just had another cup of coffee. It's Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour. This hour has been sponsored by some L.A. Truth Seekers. Some L.A. Truth Seekers. Thanks, guys, girls, both. The message, the future is here. Please consider supporting all independent voices besides Mike. Please investigate others, such as the Progressive Radio Network and Blog Talk Radio. Again, the future is here now. Thanks to the LA Truth Seekers for that sponsorship tonight. And they're absolutely right. You're not going to find a whole lot of progressive left radio available. You're just not. It's just not there. I have... You know, a couple of people that I like who are liberal talk show hosts, but they are not progressive left. They're just not. And that's okay. At least they're not right-wingers, right? But if you come across progressive left programming or writing, to the extent that you can, yeah, support it. Sometimes supporting it just means checking out the website and clicking on the ads. That's right. Just click on the ads. That's all you have to do. You don't have to buy anything. Just click on the ads. I guess you've heard the latest open mouth, insert foot moment from Mitt Romney. He made a joke the other day about closing auto plants. I mean, this guy, speaking of Mitt Romney, since we were talking about him here a second ago, what does this guy use for brains? Sawdust? I mean, I've never seen somebody so out of touch. When he goes home at night, does he say to Anne, or does he look in the mirror and go, oh my God, did I say all that today? Do I really want to be elected this badly? This guy is just absolutely a worm, a weasel. He's just, it's unbelievable. And, you know, you kind of want to just wish him away. Just, on the other hand, I hope he stays, and I hope Newt stays, and I hope Santorum just continue to rip each other to pieces, keep doing it. What did I hear on television the other night? That a candidate for the presidency has never had as high a negative disapproval numbers as Mitt Romney. 50% of the people just don't like him. That's never happened before. But you go, right-wingers. You just go ahead and put him up. Of course, Romney is not a right-winger. He's a country club Republican, and there is a difference. Don't give me that look. There is a difference. Romney is not a right-winger like Santorum is, like Gingrich is, like the rest of these freaks were. Romney is a country club Republican. You know, Romney doesn't want to see all the poor people die. Romney doesn't want to see children with no health care. What he does want is a corporatist kind of response to everything. You know, a capitalist kind of response. Capitalism with a heart. I know. It's an oxymoron. Doesn't exist. But in Romney's head, it does. I'm just pointing out Romney, not reality. But Romney, you know, has that kind of white man's burden attitude, however that translates. You know, that was the attitude during the colonial days, a white man's burden, as the Brits and the Dutch and the French and the whoever went around the world enslaving everybody, a white man's burden. Romney has that, only it's applied to the United States. And it's not just his burden is not just helping the poor downtrodden darker races, but also other white Americans who weren't born with a silver foot in their mouth. So Romney is, you know, he's a country club Republican. And I love it because that's driving the right-wing Republicans right out of their crawl space. They can't stand it. They can't take it. You know, there's Romney. Because Romney doesn't believe any of the stuff he says. He doesn't. Romney is a capitalist. He of the worst type. I'm not saying he's a nice guy. I'm saying he's a country club Republican. And maybe in his heart of hearts, he does want to see children dying because they don't have health care. He certainly has no problem forcing people out of work in order to make money. So you figure out what he is. I frankly don't give a damn. But when you consider that Romney's company, Bain Capital, forced thousands of people out of work at companies that Bain Capital purchased. And he famously opposed the bailout of the auto industry that saved hundreds of thousands of jobs. You know, his old man had been the president of American Motors. I mean, my God. But he told a joke the other day. He told several thousand voters I guess it was a conference call, that one of the most humorous, his words, one of the most humorous connections he had to the state of Wisconsin came when his father, George, closed an auto plant in Michigan and moved it to Wisconsin. When the elder Romney later ran for governor of Michigan, the plant closure became a rather sensitive subject, especially when a school band played the Wisconsin fight song at a parade. Romney laughed as he told the story yesterday. Here's what he said. So every time they would start playing on Wisconsin, my dad's political people would jump up and down trying to get him to stop because they didn't want people in Michigan to be reminded my dad had moved production to Wisconsin. Damn, is that a knee slapper or what? What?
Isn't that funny?
What?
Isn't that funny? I tell that at the country club. My dad told the Grosse Pointe Country Club, and everybody, you know, laughed. You people aren't laughing. What, is something I said? Did I say something?
I thought it was funny. You know, country club, people laid off my dad on Whiskey.
I'll see you tomorrow night, True Seekers. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.